Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present Sunak Journal with Dr. Tom Sunak. Dr. Tomislav Sunak is a former professor, author, translator, and diplomat. Visit his website for interviews, essays, books, and more at tomsunak.info. And now here's your host, Tom Sunak.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or good morning, for that matter, to folks in California. This is Tom Sunak from Croatia this time again, your host at the Voice of Reason, and I'm very, very pleased to be back on board with you again, folks. Well, guys, folks, dear friends, you may recall that over the last couple of weeks I was discussing and narrating, and I was talking, and I had as guests some very distinguished German-Americans who actually were telling me and telling us about their plight, not just in what used to be a communist Europe, in Eastern Europe, but also in a so-called democratic world. Specifically, I had last time Mr. Fuhrer, who actually was telling us about his internment as a young boy in the United States of America in Texas. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this time I'm very, very pleased. I have a gentleman who actually grew up more or less in the vicinity where I'm now sitting and where I'm actually recording this show, and actually who had his own passion play, and I'm extremely pleased and I'm very honored indeed to welcome our guest, Mr. Hans Kopp. Welcome on board, Mr. Kopp.
Welcome, Tom, and I appreciate that you give me the opportunity to talk about my experience in a death camp in communist Yugoslavia during the time 1945, 1946, and 1947.
I'm very, very pleased, Mr. Kopp, and I hope our listeners also will be aware of what we are talking about. I specifically want to talk about the real survivors. I don't want to go into semantical details now, but you have to be aware, Mr. Kopp, and I'll certainly give you a chance to talk very much in details about your childhood. You have to be aware that very, very little is known about the plight of ethnic civilian Germans in what was once ex-communist Yugoslavia, or for that matter, what was once the communist world in Eastern Europe.
Tom, let me start this way. Toward the end of 1944, to be exactly one day after Christmas, our parents, that is my parents, were deported to Russia. In February of 1945, my grandfather was deported into a slave labor camp. And March of 1945, people just simply came to our town and moved into our houses. 2 weeks later, we were expelled by gunpoint. It was about 3,500 people left from a population of 6,300 who were now marched to the death camp of Gakova. It was a three-day march, and it was absolutely, the picture that I like to paint for you is women with children under the age 2, pregnant women, children up to age 14, and people that no longer could work, mostly over 45, over 50. That was the makeup of these 3,500 people that were walking. Now, on a three-day march, the The tragedy already started while we were walking. A man collapsed in front of me, and later I found out he died. A woman gave birth to a child on the side in a ditch. So it was really a very, very bad situation for us because we had nothing to eat and nothing to drink during those 3 days.
Okay. Mr. Kopp, Hans, rather, I hope you don't mind if I call you Hans. Let me just put this
Not
in
at all.
Right. Thank you very much, Hans. Well, let's just try to situate this in a somewhat in a more simple context, just for our listeners, if you don't mind. As I understand, you were born. You were born in what was once monarchic Yugoslavia. Am I correct?
Yes, I was born in a town called Bač Sentivan, now called Prikravica, about 7-8 kilometers east of Apatin.
Okay, I know more or less where it is. It is now, dear listeners, in the jurisdiction of Serbia. So just to make the story simple for you folks, before 1941, before the first dissolution of Yugoslavia, dear listeners, there was this monarchic Yugoslavia, not communist Yugoslavia, which fell apart in 1941. So our gentleman, our guest, Mr. Kopp, he was actually born in what was once monarchic or royal Yugoslavia, if you wish. Apatin, it's nowadays more or less about, I think it's about 30 miles south of the Hungarian border. Am I correct, Mr. Kopp?
Yes, I don't know the exact distance, but I think you're close.
All right, and let me just, if I can just wrap it up in 1 minute. So your parents, I assume, were also the subject of once upon a time of what used to be Austro-Hungarian Empire.
That's correct.
Just like mine. Okay, here we go. Except that you belong to the quote-unquote the German minority and I belong to the Croatian minority. I mean, this is a hassle. You know, the reason I don't want to ridicule that, Mr. Kopp, but you have to understand that unfortunately, not just in America but also in Europe, young folks nowadays do not have a very pronounced sense of history and a very pronounced sense of geography. So please do apologize, ma'am. I'm just trying to simplify things and put them in the right context.
Yes, this is very true. You are absolutely correct.
So actually, you were born as an ex-Yugoslav citizen. I don't know if you realize that, but we can talk about this later on. You are now entitled to a Yugoslav passport, to the Serbian passport, rather. And we'll talk about this later on, because what happened in 1945, this Yugoslavia was refurbished, was cobbled together again out of those separate pieces. Anyway, to make the story short, Hans, so actually, how old were you when you ended up in this death camp, the communist death camp?
I was 9.5 years old.
And this was near Apatin. This was near 9.5 years old. So when the communists took over in December in Serbia in 1944, am I correct?
Yes.
In November, Budapest fell down, and then in Belgrade as well. And, of course, the war was still going on in Zagreb and so on. And further west, it was still part of the Reich. Now, just in terms of jurisdiction, you understand that the Reich didn't fall apart when you were captured. The war was still going on.
That is correct.
Uh-huh.
That is absolutely correct.
You were 9.5 years old, and you ended up in this communist death camp. I understand, I know personally from first-hand experience, that quite a few people died. I don't know if you know the numbers. Did you tell
us
something?
Yeah, I do know the numbers. I'm very well aware of the history, and I can
please,
recite them.
Please, do tell us something about this.
Well, we have to differentiate between internment camp and a death camp and the slave labor camp. We also have to differentiate between internment camp like a POW camp in the United States as well as Canada, and compare that to a camp in Russia. Now, my parents were deported to Russia to a slave labor camp. My mother was there 4 years. Fortunately, my father only 9 months. At that camp, basically, was installed by the communist government of Yugoslavia, simply because Tito was denied to export or to send them to Austria and Germany, because there were so many refugees from Eastern Europe. So now his next thing was to put him in the death camps, which I could more or less describe as starvation camps, mm-hmm. where you had very little food to eat. The only clothes you had was the clothes that you were expelled in. You had to sleep on straw. There were between 15 and 20 people in a room. If somebody did get ill, the conditions became worse and worse, and it is a very tragic thing. People do not realize the condition that you had to live under.
Which year was it specifically, Hans?
This was basically, we're referring to the winter of 1945-46, which was the worst time, where on the average 100, 150 and 200 people died. In mm-hmm. other words, I've seen more dead people than the average person ever will see, with the exception of an undertaker. The people a lot of times would lay there for 1 or 2 days, and then they were taken by us to the end of the street. There was a house set up as a death house, and from there a wagon, a one-horse-drawn wagon, would take them to a mass grave, and we would see 400 or 500, up to 1,000 people being placed in a mass grave. And the stench off the dead people, because they were hardly covered, was actually, people told me later on they could smell it for miles. Mm-hmm. But the conditions now, laying on straw, you had fleas, lice, you had to keep yourself clean from lice. It was a daily routine to clean yourself up. And one of my saddest experiences, of course, was a young girl. She was probably 13 years of age. Whose parents or grandparents or whomever she had died, and now she was trying to seek some connection with somebody else. And somehow we became friends, and because I was a person that would actually talk to her, and when she died, it really struck me very seriously. Before she passed away, she asked me to clean her head from lice, so I helped her. And when I looked at her head, there was probably a area of about I'd say silver dollar, and I tried to lift it up. And there was pus underneath, and the lice was just crawling in the pus. I was so scared and totally appalled, and I didn't know what to do. So I put it back, and I was really kind of, even today I think about that situation, that I could not really help that girl, and she one day in the morning I found her dead.
Mr. Hans, let me ask you, Was it an open camp? Oh, it's a euphemism. It certainly wasn't open, but there were guards around,
well,
I assume.
Okay,
there
well, were, here is the situation. The Tito partisans didn't have enough barbed wire to stretch it around the village of Gakova.
Yeah, Gakova, yes.
They had guards around it. But Gakova had a lot of small, what we call grundloch, or little lakes, from where they used to take the soil to build the houses. Now the houses, as you know, they were all stamped from soil with straw binding it, and there were a lot of these around the town. Now they were really good hiding. There were trees and shrubs. You really found yourself ways to go through unseen, and then watch where the guard was, and then just go over the 200 meter wide stretch of vegetation they had removed around the town. Mm-hmm. So there you have to go rush through there so that you're not getting caught.
Now, let me ask, were there any grown-ups? I understand there were quite a few of kids, ethnic German kids, you know, orphans, so to speak. Well, eventually they became orphans.
Yeah, they became
quite a few of adults. Where was your dad at that time?
The adults were actually... older people, like my grandmother. She was 45. We were with my grandmother, and she went out to beg, and she was caught by the partisans, and that was a week before Christmas of 1945, and so she was to be shot as an example. So they took her out of the camp on a wagon, and while my brother and I was running alongside, she took off her clothes and gave it to us. She threw it down so we would have it and could make something out of it. And then they found out they didn't really shoot him, but they took her to Krushival, and where she was raped and beaten and left to die. Mm-hmm. Somehow she regained consciousness and walked from Krushival, which is about 4 kilometers from Gakova, mm-hmm. and came to us. By that time, when she came to us, we hardly could recognize her. She could not open her mouth to speak. Her legs were black from frost bitten because she had no footwear to wear. And on December 27, she died from her injuries because nobody would help her, could help her, or even had anything. You know, there was no hospital, nothing, you know, to really, no medication, nothing.
Oh. So, let's just try to put it in a somewhat wider perspective. This was certainly not a single camp for German prisoners. I'm talking about civilian prisoners, dear ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. There were quite a few of them. In fact, there were dozens of them all over communist Yugoslavia, and they lasted literally until 1955, quite a few of them.
Actually, there were 7 so-called death camps, which Tito called camps with special status, and where people were taken to die. Then the people that were capable of working or do some kind of work, they were in various, it's not really known how many camps, slave labor camps, were There were anywhere from 20 people to 100 people between Brod and Belgrade. They had to build a train station, so there was probably about 200 people there, and they were treated very bad because they, you know, if they fell, they were practically some of them buried alive. So you know, it's a situation that is very difficult to call to talk about. You know.
Well, I'm glad that you're still a memory of that. You're encapsulating, so to speak, the memory of those people who actually perished with the shrug of eternity, if I can put it somewhat poetically. Hans, how old are you, if I may ask you? I guess I
well, now I'm 74.
70, so you're very, very young.
I was born 1935.
1935, yes, you were 9 years. And let me ask you, we'll certainly continue talking about this later on. So you did hear about other camps. Did you have any contact? Well, I need to clarify this. Where was your dad back then? Was he shipped to Siberia? Where was he? Where was
he at? No, my father was taken to Kharkov.
Kharkov, yes, in Russia, in the Soviet Union. I'm sorry.
And he was with the detail of a lumber yard, uh-huh. Where they cut various lumbers or worked lumbers for rebuilding. Some of the people there were cleaning bricks for rebuilding.
So you're talking about slave labor, right?
Slave labor. Now, my mother, on the other hand, she was at Antrazit, which is in Ukraine, and in a coal mine.
Yes,
They had to do work to get the coal mine working again, which took about 2 years so that it could produce coals. Now, that was one of the worst camps. Now, they were not particularly mistreated unless they tried to escape, but the food, they had hardly any food. And so-called no hygiene, because they had no water there at that camp. So the water they had to bring in with in a bathtub, so to speak.
So in other words, they were in Stalin's gulag. And did they survive the gulag? Did they actually manage after? And how long did they stay there?
Well, my mother was there four years. And she was one of the last ones. The camp was finally closed, after 5 years. So,
when was that? When was it closed down?
The people that were deported to Russia, they were deported for a duration of 5 years. And after 5 years, the remaining people that were alive were finally sent to East Germany, so to speak, you know, to communist Germany. But what the Russians did was actually, every so often, they sent sick people home, uh-huh. Like my father, after 9 months. And my father's transport was the only one transport that was still permitted to enter in Yugoslavia, and this was a blessing for me because my father found us still alive, right?
This is a fascinating story. We'll continue in a second. We'll just take a very, very short break. Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, as you can see, this is a very moving story by a friend of ours, by a Volksdeutscher, by an ethnic German. I don't know if you're familiar with all this tragedy on a massive, on cosmic scale that you rarely ever hear about in the American media, or for that matter in the European media, in the so-called democratic media. You always hear one side of the story, but I guess it is really appropriate once in a while to talk about the tragedy of those people, and not just ethnic Germans, but other folks. We'll just take a break, so don't go away. Thank you.
Just play their tunes, sing the songs. the moon.
We'll be back with more from Tom Sunick after this break at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
All eyes were on Maine Senator Olympia Snowe to see if she would break with fellow Republicans and support the Senate Finance Committee's $829 billion health care reform package that Committee Chairman Max Baucus worked on for months.
Let us enact this balanced, common-sense plan to improve health care. Let us reform the health care system to control costs and premiums. Let us extend health care coverage to all Americans.
One by one, Republicans voiced their opposition, complaining about cuts in Medicare, new taxes, and higher premiums.
This bill is already moving on a slippery slope to more and more government control of health care.
Snowe kept everyone guessing until late in the meeting when she revealed she would support the measure.
So is this bill all that I would want? Far from it. Is it all that it can be? No. But when history calls, history calls.
That was music to the ears of Chairman Max Baucus, who had worked weeks to try to win Snowe's support. It was also welcome news at the White House, where President Barack Obama twice praised Senator Snowe and the committee, but also cautioned there is plenty more to do to achieve his top domestic priority.
Now's not the time to pat ourselves on the back. Now's not the time to offer ourselves congratulations. Now's the time to dig in and work even harder to get this done. The ayes have it.
The final committee vote of 14-9 enables the White House to say that the bill enjoys bipartisan support.
This isn't the first time that Senator Snowe has broken with her party, but while Democrats might want to view her as a vote against any possible Republican filibuster on health care reform, Snowe made clear there's no guarantee that she will support whatever health care reform bill comes before the full Senate. Jerry Bodlander, The Associated Press, Capitol Hill.
And now let's return to Sunick Journal. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is Dr. Sunich or Tomislav Sunich or Tom, or just call me Tom. This is the easiest way. I have this creepy feeling when I listen to those stories, and I don't want to talk about myself and how my dad spent some time in the gulag as well, and he was later on adopted by the Amnesty International. But we will talk about Will Hans and his story. Hans, just a few things I forgot to ask you at the beginning. What is your profession right now, and are you familiar, are you in touch with some Volksdeutschen, some ethnic Germans in your area? Because I know personally quite a few Volksdeutschen and Donauschwaben in Canada, and I know in Anaheim and down in California. They're all over the world.
Well, I am a member with the Cleveland Donauschwaben. I live in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I've been a founding member, and ever since then I've been a member of the Cleveland Donauschwaben. I'm also a member of the German-American Federation in Cleveland.
And congratulations.
You're welcome. And one of my hobbies is gardening. So I've done the gardening for our Lanau Park, which we call the home of the Donauschwaben in Cleveland, for 8 years. And I'm doing the flowers of our cultural garden for the last 5 years. And prior to that, okay, I was one I was involved in soccer. And as you know, when the Volksdeutsche, okay, or the Dornischwarm came to the United States, they most of them socialized around soccer because the young people would play soccer, and it was like an afternoon to go to play, to watch the adults were watching us. They brought out their girls, you know, boys attract girls. So it was one of the best socialization or, you know, that we had in the United States, and consequently we formed the Society of the Dornischwarm in Cleveland in 1958. And I've been a member ever since, and I was involved in soccer very heavily in United States soccer, and I'm the founder of the Ohio Youth Soccer Association. I've been a founder of the United States State Soccer Coaching School. And in 1977, I was appointed to the Olympic Development Program for the Midwest. So I'm one of the founders of the Olympic Development Program. And so I have been very, very athletic all my life. And in 1984, I became a professional ski instructor. So I've been a soccer coach for 28 years. That means youth soccer coach. And a ski instructor for 22 years. So right now I'm retired as a mechanical engineer in the machine tool and die design field, and the last 10 years I worked as an engineering consultant in the steel industry.
Excellent.
So I have
very good background and very good references indeed. Hans, let me ask you a few technical and a few judicial questions, if I may. You were 9 years of age. You spent almost 2 years, or a little bit more actually than 2 years in communist death camp.
25 months. 25 months.
Okay, so when were you released, and how were you released, and how did you get to the United States?
Yeah, I was not released.
Uh-huh.
I escaped. My father, when he found us, he had to see that we get enough food to get our strength so we could actually walk from Gakowa to Hungary.
Okay.
And we were in Hungary, let's say this, on April 12th, we fled to Hungary.
Which year was it? I'm sorry.
1947.
Oh, 1947, April 12th, okay.
Yeah. And then we stayed in Hungary 4 months and worked for a baron who had vineyards, okay? But soon he didn't like to pay my father, okay? So I had to herd the cow, and we had to raise three little pigs. So my father went to Chicaria, which is a neighboring town. He sold the three pigs to a German butcher there. So we had money. And then with this money, we bought train tickets and we went to Baja. And from Baja, we crossed the Danube. And from there, we went across Hungary to Komorom, and not Komorom, I'm not sure exactly now, but nevertheless we finally reached the Austrian border, crossed the Austrian border to Güssing.
Okay.
And from Güssing, since that was in the Russian zone and my father did not want to have anything to do with the Russians,
mm-hmm.
we fled.
Okay.
We walked across toward the British zone, crossing a river, and from there we went to Graz, and from Graz we boarded a train, and then from there we went to Salzburg. But an interesting story. We very humorous in Graz. When we boarded the open train, you know, the railroad people came, you know, and my father paid them off with cigarettes. And after, you know, after a while, another guy came, and he had to give them cigarettes. And another guy that found out, well, these guys, you know, you go there and you scare them a little bit and they give you cigarettes, you know.
Hans, if you don't mind, let me just back up a little bit. When your dad came over and he picked you up, you survived this death camp in communist Yugoslavia, in Titoist Yugoslavia. When you moved to Hungary, I guess our listeners need to know that because Hungary was basically under Soviet occupation, right? So you're dealing with the Soviet.
Well, you're right. Okay, we were in Bacsalmas, and there. They had elections in 1947, late in 1947.
Well, these are trumped up elections. They were false with the
Right. So we knew, well, it was nothing but communist slogans, okay? There was no other slogans. Okay. So my father realized, hey, it's time to leave, so.
And our listeners need to know, dear listeners, even Vienna itself, until 1955, was partially under the Soviet jurisdiction. This was a special deal between the American allies, the American Anglo-American allies, and the Soviet Union. And keep in mind, guest Hans Kopp just mentioned Graz. Keep in mind, folks, those who are from California, my kids were born in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, our big hero, he is from Graz himself, so he experienced that. He had actually a pinch of the Soviet rule as well in Graz down south. Yes, continue, Mr. Hans. Tell us a little bit more. How did you come to the United States of America in the first place?
Well, that's also a very interesting story. My mother's great uncle came to the United States in 1905.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and in 1924... He visited Bacsentivan, and he got to know my mother. And after the war, he made real efforts to collect food, clothing, and be part of the so-called Caritas or the relief action, and he then was able to actually find us, okay? At that time, my mother still was in Russia.
Okay.
And to be truthfully, we received a list where my mother's name was on as having died, obviously. We found out later that was an error in one way or the other, because right after we got made contact with my great-great-great uncle in the United States, we received a card from my mother that she was alive in Russia.
Okay.
And about 3 months later, she was released to Eastern Europe and was able to come to Cleveland, and to Salzburg, where we took up residence. And
excuse me, Hans. So before you immigrated to the United States of America, you took up residence in Salzburg, which is, of course, in Austria, northern Austria, which was under Western jurisdiction, so to speak. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so
it was under the American zone.
It was
Salzburg was the the headquarters of the immigration was
right.
So now we were united and we started to go and
you moved
make applications,
overseas,
right? make applications, and it took us 2 years before we were able to leave in 1956, in June of 1956.
So in June 56, you moved definitely overseas, am I correct, with your parents?
Yeah, we went to Bremerhaven, and from there on General Lankfitt, we came to the United States and to Cleveland.
Well, let me ask you a direct, probably a provocative question, Hans. How come you didn't take up residence in Germany itself? Because you realize, probably our listeners don't realize, that every fifth citizen of the current, of the actual Bundesrepublik Deutschland, of the Federal Republic of Germany, is of East European ancestry, that actually his forefathers were kicked out of and expelled from Eastern Europe. So why didn't you want to stay? Why didn't you want to take up residence in Germany?
Well, my father is very eager to work.
Uh-huh.
And what actually did happen, Austrian farmers were looking for farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And the very same day when we got there, we were hired by a landlord in Austria in Obertrum, which is about 7 kilometers outside of Salzburg, who owned the brewery and a huge land tract, and he needed people to work this. So we did not move to Germany. We just found work there, and so we stayed there.
No, I'm just asking a rhetorical question because, Look, Hans, let's be frank for our listeners. It was greatly, to a great extent, to the German expertise and to the German know-how, including the German POWs, that all those countries, specifically Yugoslavia, owe their economic miracle, quote-unquote, if you see what I mean. You should probably tell a little bit more about, well, we'll talk about this some other time, that much of this American economic miracle is also due to the German brains of von Braun and the rocket industry, the rocket scientists and what have you. But just tell us a little bit more. I'm sure you're aware of the German POWs. They didn't have the same lagers, death camps, but they had similar lagers down in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It would turn out to be Yugoslavia. And I happen to be quite familiar with that chapter of the history I wrote about this. And were you familiar, at least, other than those quote-unquote civilian lagers for civilian Germans in ex-communist Yugoslavia, were you familiar on this serial killing of German POWs by communists, disarmed POWs?
Well, not till later. Of course, you know, as I said, I was a young 10-year-old boy. Okay, at that time, my only interest was surviving.
Uh-huh.
We had no connection to anyone outside because, as you know, the doctrine that Tito gave out, you couldn't use, we weren't allowed to have medicine, we could not take transportations, we were totally cut off. And as a matter of fact, they did not even let the Serbian and Yugoslavian people come close to, so that they would not know what was going on in that camp, in these type of camps. So,
Sure, I understand that perfectly. Did you have any civilian encounters with the Serbian populace? Because, of course, our listeners need to know that the Hungarian minority from Vojvodina, this area where you were interned, they were literally kicked out into Hungary. There was a massive human transfer, the transfer of population. But did you have any contact on a personal level with some boys, some girls of the Serbs, because they were on the victorious side, and I'm sure you may have heard of them after all those months spent in this death camp?
Well, frankly speaking, no. The only contact we would have, if we sneak out at the camp and go begging, and this was almost a routine of every week, you had to eat, and the food in the dead camps was not enough. In other words, during the winter of 1945, what we did get, for example, was beets, cow beets. Mm-hmm. And the cow beans were frostbitten. At first, you know, we ate them. They tasted good because it was something different. But then we got sick, diarrhea, all kinds of, I mean, you name it. We had, during that winter, we had typhus, malaria, you know, and it is absolutely appalling, what was going on. There was no hygiene. You know, we had to dig a big hole in the backyard, okay, and everybody had to run there, and if you had diarrhea, you hardly made it there, and a lot of times you soiled yourself from top to bottom, you know, mm-hmm. And I mean it, you know, I cannot paint the picture as gross as it was, you know.
Yeah. Yes, Hans, I think I got a pretty clear cut idea, and I'm very pleased that you're really on my show, and I would really like to alert my audience and our friends who listen to us to study more this this issue of ethnic Germans or Volksdeutschen or Donauschwaben in this area of Europe, which is basically the area around the Danube River, hence the name Donauschwaben, which was heavily populated prior to 1939 by ethnic Germans, 1.5 million, ladies and gentlemen, ethnic Germans. And later on, of course, they were also the citizens of respective jurisdictions, Hungarian, Yugoslav jurisdiction, Romanian jurisdiction. And when Yugoslavia fell apart, they became citizens of Croatia, citizens of Serbia, and citizens of Hungary. So anyway, this is really a horror story, and I'm very, very pleased, Hans, to have you on my show.
Yeah.
And
may I interject something?
Sure, by all means.
I'm also an author, as you know. I have written, among others, a book and a lot of articles, which you find on donauschwaben-usa.org under history.
Please repeat it again. Say again the website. Okay.
The website is donauschwaben. Donauschwaben-usa.org.
Excellent. And we'll have it. We'll have it announced on our site.
And you go to history. There is a whole section which is devoted to some of my work, and one of which is Misery, Life in a Dead Camp, which if your listeners read that, they would get even a more graphic picture of my experiences, my personal experiences.
Well, Hans, I'm very pleased, and I, between you and me, I'd like you to be my guest along with the Weasel and other Elie Wiesel and other weasels of the world, so we can face him with you, and that would be a nice show. And probably one of these days, you never know, we'll make another movie with Glorious Bastards. Who knows, you know? But you know, if we can just put it a little bit in a wider perspective, in a wider historical perspective, isn't that strange that we always hear about the victimology of, let's say, the Somalis, or for that matter, Palestinians? With all due respect, I have a great deal of respect for all nations that suffer in the world. But never, ever, never, ever do we hear about this passion play. I don't know what word I can use. We're talking about 13 million ethnic German civilians were literally thrown out of the country, and in the process, we're talking about 6 or 7 months, folks, so don't tell me about expatriation. It can go fast if you can follow me fast. 3 million were killed in the process.
That is just an opinion, okay, and you can take it any way you wish.
Sure.
But I think since the allied nations were greatly responsible for this expelling Germans and from the east and southeast, That's why they probably do not want to
talk about it. Yes.
Well, about their own guilt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And hence the reason that I don't want to go into details, but you will understand, and my listeners certainly will, that we always hear on the hit parade of, that's a good word, hit parade of suffering, we always hear one side, but we never hear the other side. And yes, indeed, I hate to say that, you know that, Hans, that the Croats, traditionally, they were always loyal since the 30 Years' War, and for 400 years, Croats were very intertwined with the German, with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And Croats suffered a similar plight after the Second World War. They were summarily executed. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
Just for the information of our listeners, folks, there are also some good books on German POWs who were disarmed by the English in southern Austria in April of 45. And, of course, you can imagine what happened to that was Army Group E, which was actually which was led by General Leur. He was actually executed with dozens of other officers, high officers, in Belgrade afterwards. It was a mini replica of the Nuremberg trials in Belgrade all over Eastern Europe. So we are talking about the massive serial executions, which of course were to a large extent condoned by the Western Allies. But let's leave aside high politics. Let's just, for 2 more minutes we got, Hans, let's just suffer. Let's just focus a little bit on this human suffering of civilians, of young people, of young children. Isn't that a shame? Every day we talk about this. We got only a couple of minutes left, but I just need your final opinion, Hans. What do you think? On day after day, we hear about this human rights philosophy. Like we bewail, we actually whine over sufferings of children in the distant antipodes and what have you. But we never hear about the real suffering that you went through. Are we talking here? Are we dealing here with double standards? What do you think?
Well, actually, I haven't given it much thought. I think I'm with you on that people should not suffer. And there's quite a big difference as to what people perceive as freedom, human rights, and we've seen that in the current situation, okay, where we have freed Afghanistan women, we have freed 25 million Iraqis, and yet this is not appreciated by the world. So I don't know what to say, some people perceive as being human rights and others do not. So,
Hans, thank you. I can tell you one thing, Hans, on philosophical level. Your answer is so sharp and so incisive, and I truly admire that, because this again tells us about the relativity, about the whole philosophical relativity of this concept of human rights. Well, Hans, well, thank you very, very much. I'm sure I'll have you on my show again. And ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate having Hans Kopp on board. Please do not hesitate to contact him. Hans, just a last question. I'm sure people can get a hold of you on this Donau Schwaben org website. I'm sure you have an email over there.
Correct.
I hope you wouldn't mind, on a personal level, if I get in touch with some students who are doing graduate studies on Eastern Europe and the plight of ethnic Germans. I hope you wouldn't mind if I give them your email.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I have been in contact with a couple of young ladies in Hungary that do graduate work. Here in the United States, I have supplied them with material. And so, not at all. I'd be willing to help anyone that is making our history known.
Absolutely.
So,
Und wir sollten das auch auf Deutsch sagen, weil wir haben auch die Zuhörer, die deutschsprachig sind. Und du sprichst, Hans, nicht wahr, ein bisschen Deutsch?
Ja, ich spreche nicht nur ein bisschen, ich spreche perfekt.
Ja, das ist sehr gut zu hören. Ladies and gentlemen, we just had a briefing in the German language. It's an admirable language indeed, and you should study that, because the German culture is much, much deeper, folks, than what you hear from. It doesn't just stretch from 33 to 1945. It's far deeper than that. I would be happy to help you.
And Hans, Tom, I wanted to say this, und ich sage das jetzt auf Deutsch. Ich habe das Buch mit Absicht in zwei Sprachen geschrieben. In Deutsch und das gleiche Material in Englisch. So I wrote the book in English and German.
Yeah, oh yeah, I'm glad to hear that, folks. We have an additional reason now to contact Hans. Hans, let me also express my best wishes to Anita Pare, a good friend of mine. I'm sure you know her. She's from Toronto. And there is a large German-Canadian community. Yeah. They've always treated me nicely, and, you know, I'm at home, basically. Hans, thank you very, very much.
Should you ever come to Cleveland, please do visit us.
Well, you know that Croats are just like Germans. They're crazy about soccer. So here's the reason why.
Well, I know. I had a lot of experience with
Croatian soccer players, I certainly will, Hans, and I'll give you a call also, and thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for your patience, and please, for further reference, it will be announced on the VOR site. I would like also to express my gratitude to Steve from VOR, Voice of Reason, and for further reading about the ethnic Germans and the German POWs, please consult and look at my website. Thank you, Hans, once again, and see you later. Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Sunik Journal will return next Tuesday night from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.